We now turn to chapters 1 to 39 in Evagrius' arguably most influential work, his Practikos, which is also subtitled The Monk. The term Practikos, as we've described, means the one who is engaging in asceticism. So it's about the practice of asceticism, but as we'll see, it's intended to be the first book of a spiritual trilogy. It's intended to be the book that describes ascetical practice and is to be read together with his book The Gnostikos, which describes contemplative practice, which describes the ability to look at things, to behold the scriptures, to behold the world, and to see them clearly as the presence of God. One might say that in this first work, Practikos, his goal is to help people see God especially present in the battlefield and place of struggle, which is their own hearts, in their own struggle with temptation, to understand the different kinds of temptations, to work out what the remedies are, to perceive their own particular kind of tendencies, and then to discover how best to deal with them. This is the primary ascetical project as far as Evagrius is concerned. His second book in this trilogy, The Gnostikos, would lead one into the process of, as it were, looking up from the arena of the heart to look into the glorious text of the scriptures, which of course one would have been using all along as a source book for this ascetical struggle, but now to begin to look at the scriptures and indeed at the world around oneself as resplendent with the glory of God, to look at it with eyes that are capable of looking beneath the surface. So the Gnostikos is about using the skills that you acquire in the practice, in ascetical struggle, to help you see God in broader events and in salvation history. The third book in his trilogy, as we'll see, the Cephalia Gnostica, was intended as a spiritual workbook, which is very easy to misunderstand. To try to give you an analogy, one might say that that third book would be as if we took from this course only the questions that you're asked at the end of each week, and we put those together in a list, and that's all you had. It wouldn't make a lot of sense unless you had the whole coursework. In the same way, Evagrius' Cephalia Gnostica doesn't really make any sense unless you look at it together, especially with his exegetical writings. And unfortunately, it's been very badly misunderstood throughout the centuries. But we're looking here at the Practikos. This has been a very enduring text. It's been read consistently in the Greek tradition in the original. It was very rapidly assigned to Nihilus. It was read and strongly recommended, even though this was a period after which Evagrius' name was regarded as problematic. And in fact, it's contained within the Philokalia, the text which is read and recommended in the Orthodox Church, particularly for and by people who are practicing the Jesus Prayer, the hesychastic method of prayer. Sections from it have widely influenced the Christian West. It provides the structure of and most of the insights of John Cashin's Book of Institutes and quite a lot of what you find in the conferences as well. Well, let's look at this text, which really is intended to be a guide for people who are engaged in the process of trying to understand their own struggle with temptation and to make progress in Christian virtue. He begins with an allegorical interpretation of the monk's habit. Now, that may seem rather odd to us, but it's been a very ancient tradition within Christianity up until relatively recently. It was a part of how one understood vestments. Priests would pray vesting prayers when they vested, many still do, and the symbolic association of different aspects of the vestments, the amice standing for the helmet of salvation, the stole standing for the yoke of immortality, the chasuble, a symbol of love, the alb as a symbol of the purity which we are intended to acquire and which we've already been gifted with in baptism. All of these things have remained a standard way of understanding Christian external symbol that refers to internal change, and Evagrius is engaging in exactly this project, which, by the way, reminds us of the fact that the monastic habit is of very great antiquity. It's not a medieval invention. It was regarded as significant that those who belonged to monastic communities wore a particular kind of vesture already in the 300s. And we aren't going to look at the details of this, except to note that in number two, and by the way, this allegorical interpretation of the habit is really a letter of introduction to the practikos itself, as if to say that which surrounds you, that which you wear every day, is itself a kind of commentary on the spiritual journey. Effectively, that's what Evagrius is saying. He says, for example, and this is kind of interesting, that the hood, the kukulion, is a symbol of the grace of the Savior and of God. It is a sheltering of the mind. It's a kind of a nursing of a childlike relationship with Christ, because this hood, this kind of hooded garment that they wore, was regarded as something that was more common for children to wear. And this this is thought of as being a beautiful and important virtue, and of course spiritual childhood, a kind of a childlike relationship with the Lord, is something that revives periodically in Christian spirituality, most recently in the spirituality of the Little Flower of Saint Therese of Lisieux. So if we drop down towards the end of this letter of introduction, prologue 8, he says that the habit is a symbol that summarizes effectively all of the virtues, and he says that while receiving it, while receiving the monastic schema or habit, the person offering the investiture with these garments describes the virtues of faith steadied by fear of God. So he's giving a series, or a kind of a series of steps or stages of virtues that are to be acquired and practiced. Faith steadied by fear of the Lord, strengthened by continence, that is made unshakable by endurance, patient endurance, and by hope. So he's combining faith, hope, and love with the classical virtues, and as we'll see, adding some of his own. After hope, for him comes apatheia, a very important theological concept which Evagrius inherits from Clement of Alexandria and from others from the Stoic tradition. It does not mean emotionlessness at all. It does not mean not caring, which is what one might be tempted to interpret it as meaning. It means not being subject to compulsions and addictions, not being subject to that which makes you passive and destroys your freedom. Apatheia is that which makes us truly free, the capacity to choose even when we are caught up in the storm of temptation or difficult choices. It's the ability to look with, one translation is dispassion, another might be with tranquility, with equanimity on difficulties and a kind of a raging storm of circumstances. That leads to real agape, he says. It leads into love, and love itself then leads into physiki, this first part of contemplative experience where we find God in creation, in nature, that which God has made, and that leads in beyond itself to the God who is beyond word, beyond image, which he calls theologia, or theology, a very technical but very common use of this term, which one also finds in such writers as Gregory Nazianzen. Theology for them means language concerning the divine nature, which ultimately transcends language. So Evagrius is here creating a kind of a stepwise progression of virtues that gives one a sense of what one needs to have in the heart in order to move from faith to this transcendent experience of God. And if we drop down in Prologue 9, he explains very clearly that his intention is to describe here in the Practikos, in 100 chapters, the ascetic practice that one needs to engage in, that one needs to work on within the depths of the heart. Then he says he will describe matters of knowledge into 50, that's his book, The Gnostikos, and then 600, which is a continuation of, which is a kind of a workbook called the Cephalia Gnostica, and we'll say a little more about that when we look at the Gnostikos. So let's drop down then to number one, this treatise on the Practici. Christianity, he says, is the teaching of our Savior Christ. It is rooted in the experience of Christ himself and Christ's own teaching, and it consists in, and remember this threefold model or threefold aspect of spiritual growth and development and maturity, asceticism or the practici, the contemplation of nature, physici, and theology, theologici. Now, we've already seen that in Origen and in Clement. He's simply passing on what he's received. He gives technical terms, the kingdom of heaven on the one hand and the kingdom of God on the other, to, in number two, physici, with apatheia, with this ability to look freely to look with tranquility on the emotional storms of the world. That gives one what he calls true knowledge of beings, of things that have been called into being. And God also, according to your capacity, allows you to move into what he calls knowledge of the Holy Trinity, an experience of God transcending word and image. We're only going to be able to highlight certain chapters, but I invite you to go back and take a look, dipping into this as much as you like. Number 5 is particularly interesting and rather delightful. He says that although the hermits engage in naked combat against the demons in community, the demons arm the more careless of the brethren. So the problem with those who live in community will be that the demonic element is trying to make you think that your brother is a demon. The difficulty in community will be that your sister or brother seems to you to be the one who is wielding the weapons of the demons, and in fact may well be acting as their instrument. So the task will be, and we'll see this at the very end in chapter 89 of the Practicos especially, the task will be to love the other despite how they may be or may have been defaced by the efforts of the demons to twist them into instruments. So it's a very interesting insight that life in community is difficult because one is tempted to mistake the brother or the sister for the demonic. And one has to be clear, even if they are the instrument of that which is destructive, they are not themselves the source of destructiveness. In number 6, and you'll see that in several points in this text, this Practicos here and in our next lecture, I've tried to indicate with a slightly different background this tripartite division of the soul. 8 generic thoughts, 8 logismoi, 8 tempting thoughts, he says, is how we should understand our own spiritual struggle. And the first, which has to do primarily with the epithumeticon, with the part of the self that is subject to desire or longing, is the part of the self that is subject also to a fallenness, to a misuse of the capacity for desire, which should in a holy way lead us to God, but which in vices leads us into gluttony, to sexual immorality, to love of money, literally love of silver in the Greek, philargyria. We also find the vices having to do with a part of ourselves that's capable of indignation, ideally in a good sense, but it can also be warped into a kind of gloominess or sadness, a deliberate choosing to remain stuck in negativity, anger, orge, and acidia, a kind of listlessness that is at the same time a despising of the things that would make us holy. Then the most dangerous vices, interestingly, and in the later tradition, Dante agrees with this, that the most dangerous and destructive vices, the ones that carry you into the deepest part of separation from God, are not the ones we've just described, but the sins by which angels fall, vainglory and pride. We'll see how Vagrius describes these very shortly. And those for him are the 8 tempting thoughts. These are the forerunners of the medieval 7 deadly sins. Well, they're adapted and changed a bit, but basically Evagrius is providing the structure according to which the quest to overcome vices and inculcate virtues will be understood for more than 1,500 years after his time. So he then describes the 8 tempting thoughts. Number 7 describes gluttony. He interestingly points out that it's not just a question of wanting food. Gluttony creates fantasies within the mind that encourage one to abandon asceticism. Gluttony, he will say, is not just a question of wanting to eat special stuff, but imagining that you will become sick if you don't have delicacies. The tempting thought, or the logismos, and he sometimes equates these logismoi, these tempting thoughts, with demons. He uses the terms interchangeably, as if to say that the demonically inspired thought, that's his kind of shorthand, as it were, for it. This tempting thought of gluttony actually has to do with a series of fantasies that are specifically intended to cause you to abandon the whole project of asceticism. Sexual immorality is fairly obvious in terms of a lustful longing or desire. avarice, and here again, it's much more subtle than one would imagine. It's not just a question of trying to possess something, which in the monastery might be difficult, but it's instead a reminder that, gosh, if you don't have anything, think how hard it's going to be when you're old. You won't have anybody to take care of you. You won't be able to offer hospitality to others. Won't that be embarrassing? So he points out the very subtle and very destructive ways in which our real temptations happen, not just the overt temptation to want to possess, but the things, the fantasies, the secondary ideas that this creates in our mind, which leads us into all sorts of false directions. Gloominess, lupe, or sadness, which is self-willed, he says, can arise from a variety of sources. And then in number 11, anger he describes as the sharpest passion, the one that is most seriously felt. As we'll see, he also points out that it is the one that is in some ways most long-lasting. This is the one that we struggle against until the moment of our death. Everything else may be able to kind of fade to some extent, but we must constantly be on our guard against anger, especially the kind of anger that, as he says here, causes the noose to see back the face of a distressing person, in which we are regarding the other as the primary problem. There's a beautiful and rather winsome or humorous depiction of Achidia, which I'd invite you to read on your own, number 12, which is a very beautiful description of how it can take an agitated or a depressed form. This hatred of doing the thing that will actually make you holy, which is what Achidia or listlessness is, it's not just laziness. It can also be a kind of an aggressive and eager desire to do anything else except the thing you need to do in order to be doing the work of God. And he has this rather humorous description of it. Now, vainglory and pride, number 13 and 14, deserve close attention, because what one finds is that they are very closely related and sometimes confused with one another. In vainglory, one is, as it were, and this is the real subtle destructive aspect of it, one is detaching oneself from others. It isn't even a question of wanting to possess. It isn't a question of wanting to dominate. Suddenly, others don't matter anymore. It's like C.S. Lewis's beautiful and wonderful and frightening book, The Great Divorce, in which he depicts a journey from hell or purgatory and into heaven. And he points out that separation from God is self-willed, and it can become a place in which you dwell and can choose to dwell for all eternity. Well, with vainglory, the process is beginning. A person looks at other people only as a source of seeing wonderful things about the self. Others tell me beautiful things about me. That's their purpose. They exist in order to reflect back to me a kind of what he calls empty hope or empty desire. But at least in vainglory, people still exist. People are still there, even if they are becoming less and less real. But in pride, the worst and most destructive aspect of it is that the soul does not admit even the help of God. It imagines in its insanity that it is responsible for its own achievements, and it despises the brethren. So pride is ultimately a wrenching away of even those last vestiges of connection to community. In pride, I deny my connectedness to others. I am responsible for my own achievements. You deny that grace has been mediated to you by others. You have, as he puts it, disdain for the brethren. And most tragic of all, you fail to admit your dependence on God. This is truly to live in a state of self-willed separation from God. And he says that it leads into a kind of insanity or madness. And it is really living in a state of separation, which one can describe as damnation, as a state of hell, whether one's alive or dead. So the next section, beginning with chapter 15, he provides, if you will, tactics, things that you can do against or about these eight tempting thoughts. And here again, I've tried to use the same background colors to highlight these different parts of the self. The noose, the part of the self subject to vainglory and pride, is stabilized, he says, by reading, what we would call Lectio Divina, by vigils, by praying at night, and by prayer itself. And as we'll see, prayer for him is both prayer in words and using images, but also and especially a prayer in which one allows oneself simply to rest in the presence of God. So reading, vigils, and prayer help stabilize this ruling or governing part of the self. The epithumia, or desiring part, can be dealt with by hunger, by fasting, by labor, and by solitude, by spending time in kind of separation from community. But thumos, or anger, indignation, when it's being used inappropriately, is calmed by, he says, the singing of psalms, the action of psalmody, by patiently enduring the difficulties you experience from others, and by mercy, by acts of compassion, which means that thumos has to be solved in community. You cannot heal thumos in isolation. Epithumia, yes, but not thumos. So he's giving some very specific recommendations here, and he also points out these things must be engaged in at the appropriate time and in proper measure. You can't simply use these remedies, you have to use them rightly. Well, let's move rather quickly through through the rest of this. I'm afraid we have to drop down to number 22. He points out how the demons will tempt us to do the wrong thing and at the wrong time. When we're being tempted by wrath, they will tell us that we should be in isolation and solitude. And when we're tempted by lust or desire, the demons, the demonic, the tempting thought will tell us, ooh, you need to solve this in community. And Evagrius says, no, the opposite is true. Be aware of the appropriate time, the appropriate setting for working on and working with and using the fitting remedy. In 23, he points out that the danger of many of these temptations is what he calls the fantasizing of images, an inability to offer pure prayer to God, that the real goal of the demonic is to stop us praying. And so these images that are created in the mind, these terrible fears or uncertainties that are created, not just by the experience of gluttony or lust, but the fantasies that are created are all a series of illusions which the demons try to use to keep us from praying, to keep us from offering ourselves ultimately to God. That's the goal of the demonic, he says. If we drop down then a little further, in 34, he gives a definition of passion. We've already hinted at it, or he describes the fact that passions are the things that sweep up and make us unfree, that make us incapable of choosing. And in number 36, he describes what we've already said, that what he calls the passions of the soul, which you find out in number 35, include things like anger. These go on until we die, until the moment of death. But the goal, he says in number 36, the whole point of this is to enable us to contemplate the struggle itself. When we engage in the struggle against our vices, we learn about ourselves. We begin to, as he will put it in a later part of the Practicos, to understand the battlefield better. And that will mean, of course, that we understand better how to employ the appropriate remedies, and we, in our turn, will be able to advise others. We become better spiritual directors for understanding, for contemplating, for looking contemplatively at the battlefield of the heart.